So last time, we saw the four-dimensional Dirac algebra. Well, we saw a more general thing, but what's important for the rest of this course is the four-dimensional Dirac algebra. And we found that our spinner, the Dirac spinner, has four components. And the Lorentz transformation matrices which act on these Dirac spinners are 4x4 matrices. And they're functions of the underlying Lorentz transformation lambda. Sorry, did someone say? And those guys, we chose that they should have the form some exponentiation of where omega, alpha, beta are the real parameter of boosts of rotations, and the sigma, alpha, beta are the generators, and these are 4x4 matrices. We take the A, B component of them, and the generators were defined to be I by 4. Is that the normalization I chose? I think so, right? I always forget this. So a convenient basis in which to express the Dirac matrices is the Weyl basis. It's also known as the chiral basis. And some people will use the word representation here as well. And is the basis in which gamma 5, which we define to be minus I 0, so sigma 0, 1, 2, 3, this is diagonal. So this is so in this basis, the Dirac matrices take this form. Where the four sigma mu matrices are defined to be the set whose zeroth component is just the 2x2 identity matrix. And its three other components are the Pauli matrices, where the sigma bar of mu is this. So in the Weyl basis, a Dirac spinner can be expressed in terms of a left-handed Weyl spinner and a right-handed Weyl spinner. Sorry, let me use a different notation here. And the explicit form of the generators of the spinner representation So from these formulae, we can now find out how the left-handed spinner and the right-handed Weyl spinner transformed under Lorentz transformation. So we start with how the Dirac spinner transforms, and it goes to under Lorentz transformation. Let's pick an infinitesimal transformation. So we pick this to be the identity operator, some boosts, and here are the generators of the boosts. And the generators are of rotations acting on the original spinner. If you now use the explicit relationship, the expressions for the Dirac spinner and the generators that we use over there, then that means that psi L transforms in this way. I'm now defining these guys to be beta. There are three betas here, and there you're taking the dot product with the sigma matrices over two. And these are the rotation, is a rotation along some direction, and this is how the left-handed Val spinner transforms. So the right-handed Val spinner transforms differently. So this representation is known as the half comma zero rep, and this one is called 0.5, and the half refers to the rotation part of it. So these are inequivalent representation. These are inequivalent, meaning that there doesn't exist any matrix, say U, you know, such that you can get the generators for the left-handed transformation, for the left-handed representation from the right-handed Val representation by some similarity transformation. So there is no such thing, and that's why they're equivalent. If there was such a matrix that could transform all the generators in one representation to another representation, then they would be equivalent. In fact, the next thing I'm going to say can give you a clue as to how to prove this, although I will not go into the detail of this proof. So the left-handed Val representation, which I'm just gonna roughly write is like this, or let's not use, okay. That this guy is actually related by complex conjugation. To the right-handed Val representation. And to see this, let's consider this identity. You'll have to use this identity. If you take if you take the three Pauli matrices, any of those, and multiply them by sigma 2, then on both sides, then you get the complex conjugate of this matrix. There are only three relationships to ships here, so you can verify it for yourself. If you use this and the properties of Pauli matrices, such as, you know, they all square to one, then you can show that the left-handed vowel spinner, if you take its complex conjugate and multiply it by 2, that object transforms in this way. So in other words, the complex conjugate of the left-handed vowel spinner up to multiplied by some matrix is actually a right-handed vowel spinner. See, this guy and this guy transforms in the same way. And you have to do some manipulations using sigma 2 and sigma 2 squared insert, and then commute to those things and things like that. So let me say just a few words about what happens in odd dimensional spacetime. So let me use the example of 5 dimensions. So in 5 dimensions, you know, we'll have 5 Dirac matrices, and so we'll have gamma 0, gamma 1, gamma 2, gamma 3, and gamma 4. But note that if you think about how we constructed the Dirac representation, what we did that we paired them up into creation and annihilation operators. So we can only pick 2 pairs. So the 5th one, say this guy, will not be part of any pair of creation and annihilation operator. So the representation that we can build up using the same technique as before will still be 4-dimensional, because there is no extra creation or annihilation operator. In fact, so these matrices will still be 4x4, even in 5 dimensions. In fact, gamma 4 is nothing but what we call gamma 5 times I. I put the I here because our normalization convention is that the spatial matrices square to minus 1, and the way we had constructed gamma 5 is that it squared to plus 1. So I insert an I here. Times are, yeah, the same definition as I used before. So in general, a Dirac spinner in d-dimensional spacetime has 2 to the power d, the integer part of d by 2 complex components. So this means take the integer part. So you might ask the same question as we asked in even dimension, whether this representation is reducible. Well, if you might want to then try to construct something like this. But using the definition, using the Dirac algebra, you can show that this is proportional to the identity matrix. And you can show that there is no other, you know, so yeah. So that your analogous technique fails in odd dimension. So in odd dimension, the Dirac spinner is actually an irreducible representation of the Lorentz group. So in odd dimension, another way of saying the same thing is no left-handed or right-handed wall spinners. The kind of spinners you can have in different dimension is extremely dimension dependent. There are other exotic structures you can have on spinners, which I won't go into. Those of you who are interested in this, I recommend that you look up Polchinski. String Theory, Volume 2, Appendix. So now we come to our next topic, which is Lagrangians for spinners. Because we are physicists, we want to have equations of motion. So we want to know how to construct Lagrangians for spinners. Hang on just one second. Yes. By geometric, I mean something that does not depend on what basis you choose to represent them in. So for example, I choose the Weyl and the chiral basis over there. And in the Weyl and the chiral basis, a Dirac spinner decomposes very neatly into a left-handed Weyl spinner and a right-handed Weyl spinner. So this looks, you know, this is a relationship that is only valid in the Weyl basis. In general, in a general basis, the relationship is the Dirac spinner is given by, you know, this guy is given by the left-handed projection operator acting on the Dirac spinner, and this is given by the right-handed projector acting on the Dirac spinner. Actually, I'm not going to write it like this. Let me rewrite this because I don't want to mess up the notation. What I mean is that a Dirac spinner can be written as, you know, a projection operator left times the projection operator right acting on the Dirac spinner. You know, this is nothing but the identity, right? So this is PL of psi of D plus PR, you know, psi of D. So this is the general relationship that we have in any basis. This is a left-handed Weyl spinner. And this is a right-handed Weyl spinner. Now, if I go to the chiral basis, then this guy is given by, in the chiral basis, PL is given by this object, whereas this guy is given by this. Now, if you were to look at the Dirac spinner in some arbitrary basis, so in some arbitrary basis, it'll have four components, but you cannot say that the first two components correspond to a left-handed valve spinner, or the right, or lower two components correspond to a right-handed valve spinner. In a general basis, you can't say that. But, you know, this relationship is basis independent. Okay? So, Lagrangian for spinners. So, you know, before we can write down the Lagrangians, we need a little bit more, a bit more machinery again. So, recall that we had an useful identity, a useful identity. And that the generator of the Lorentz transformation acting on space-time points were given by this. If you stare at these two formulae for a little while, it should become obvious to you that this guy is, well, okay. Before we write down what the finite version of this is, let's use this over here and rewrite this formula. So using this definition, we can express the right-hand side as taking the matrix element of this. So now if you just kind of, you know, think about it for a second, it should become clear to you that this is the infinitesimal version of this relationship. Okay. Sorry? M is the generator of, yeah, so M is essentially, you know, when you do x mu goes to lambda mu nu of x nu, these are the Lorentz transformation matrices. And these matrices are essentially, can be, you know, we can write this in terms of some, you know, the six Lorentz transformation parameters, which let's call them alpha, mu, alpha, beta, omega. And they will be contracted with some 4x4 matrices, which are labeled by two indices, antisymmetric. So these M's are the generators. And the definition of that M is this. You express that, you expand that in taking omega to be, you know, infinitesimal, you expand this. And of course, on the left-hand side, you see there is a similarity transformation. So that will give you a commutator. On the right-hand side, there's just a matrix multiplication, which will just give you this thing, right? So, this shows, you know, this proves a claim I made earlier that the spin, okay, I'm just gonna, the spin 1,3 group is a double cover of SO1,3. The right-hand side, these are elements of SO1,3. These guys are elements of what I'm calling the spin group. And on the left-hand side, there are two of them. So if there is an S of lambda, which corresponds to lambda, there must be another S of lambda, which is minus of S of lambda, which corresponds to the same thing. Sorry? Yeah, why minus? Because if you make a Lorentz transformation where you're transforming the spinner by S of lambda, and then you make a 360-degree rotation of a spinner, you pick up a minus sign. So you know that if this guy is in this spin group, this guy must also be in this spin group, right? Yeah, because it's quadratic. The minus signs cancel out, whereas, you know, they give you the same lambda on the right-hand side. Because in space-time, if you take a rotation matrix that rotates something by 360 degrees, right, and then that's just the identity matrix. So if you multiply the right-hand side with the rotation matrix in space-time, it will give you the same lambda. You make a Lorentz transformation and then do a rotation with like 360 degrees. That's the same thing as doing just a Lorentz transformation. But on spinner space, that's not the same thing. You pick up a minus sign. So you see that every Lorentz transformation, you know, this is just the most basic fact about rotation, you know, couched. I'm just saying that in some, a little fancy mathematical way, okay? Okay, this is how this is defined. In this case, it's actually two copies of SL2C, the group of 2x2 complex matrices with unit determinant. S stands for unit determinant, L stands for linear transformation, and I will actually show that, if time permits, okay?
Here you use the transformation property of gamma matrix for the transformation property of the spinner. So why you focus more on the gamma matrix than the transformation property of the spinner?
Sorry, I'm not following. They're kind of, you know, they're interchangeable. But here what I'm trying to do is that I'm trying to relate the space-time transformations with the transformation on the basic objects that act on spinner space, which are the gamma matrices. Okay. I mean, you can generalize this. You can now see how, I'm not sure if I follow your question. Right, so okay, let me put down the spinner indices. That'll probably be better, okay? So this guy has some spinner index AB, and that acts on the gamma matrix index B, C, and C acts on C of D. So the on the right-hand side then, this gamma matrix should have index A and D, okay? So there are lots of indices here, but I suppressed the spinner indices, which I'm now writing. Okay, so what's the first thing you want to construct? A Lagrangian is a scalar quantity, right? So let's first try to construct a scalar out of spinners. So now it's kind of a cookbook. So you might say, okay, let's try this. Let's try this, okay? And we'll see that it doesn't work. So we know how this guy transforms. To find out how this guy transforms, psi dagger, we have to find out an interesting property of the dagger of gamma mu. Now, just by using some basic algebra, Dirac algebra, you can show that this is gamma 0, gamma mu, gamma 0. So the elements of the Dirac algebra are related to their Hermitian conjugate by this relationship. It's very easy to show. And then it follows from the definition of the generators that the Hermitian conjugate of the generators then are also related to themselves in this fashion. Now, if I take the psi dagger, then the way psi transforms tells me that psi dagger must transform in this way. Remember that here we had a minus sign for the transformation of psi. So now we'll have a plus sign, I by 2. The boost and the rotation parameters are real numbers, so they don't change. But our generators are famously not Hermitian, because if the generators were Hermitian, then our transformation, this representation would be unitary. And we know that that's not unitary. We discussed this last time. So we see then that because this guy is not Hermitian, and let's just for reference write what psi transforms, although you've seen it a million times by now. So these two matrices don't cancel each other out in this combination. Therefore, it is not this is not a scalar. So Dirac figured a way out. He introduced what is now known as the Dirac conjugate. So the Dirac conjugate, which is tradition is denoted by psi bar, is psi dagger multiplied by gamma zero on the right. So now, under a Lorentz transformation, how does this transform? Well, psi dagger, we can just first use that, I by 2 omega mu nu, gamma mu nu dagger. But now there's a gamma naught coming from the definition of psi bar. But gamma naught squares to 1. So we can always introduce a gamma naught squared here. And one of those gamma naught multiplies psi dagger to make that into a psi bar. And we have one gamma naught left over. Because gamma naught squares to 1, we can now expand this exponential. And you can convince yourself that you can actually take these both gamma naughts simultaneously into the argument of the exponential. And therefore, we have psi bar exponential of I by 2 omega mu nu gamma naught sigma mu nu bar gamma naught. But we know that when you, this relationship, which you can also express in this way, because gamma naught are Hermitian, this gives us psi bar exponential of I by omega mu nu sigma mu nu. And this guy will cancel this guy. And therefore, we have constructed a scalar quantity out of a Dirac spinner and its Dirac conjugate. So this is a space-time scalar. So I'm not going to write over there. Sorry?
I mean, under SO, 1, 3, everything. What happens if we have a parity split, like if we have a space time?
That's exactly what I'm going to discuss now. Yes. So it turns out that it is useful. Yes. Oh, right. Okay, good. So what I'm doing is, so psi bar is psi dagger gamma naught, right? So under Lorentz transformation, the gamma naughts don't change. They're just matrices. So when I make a transformation over my underlying spacetime, we saw that psi dagger transformed like this. So we have psi dagger e to the power plus I by 2 omega mu nu sigma mu nu. But there's a gamma naught left over here, right? And that's the gamma naught I've written here, okay? So it comes from the definition of psi bar. Yeah? The physical meaning of the Dirac conjugation. Right, so when we quantize the field, you'll see that when the Dirac field, the Dirac field operator will contain a particle creation operator and an antiparticle destruction operator. So the conjugate will create, will have the opposite operators, But in so that's the, and also it is the, but you know, okay, so that's one way of looking at it, but you'll see that psi dagger also has those objects because psi dagger is just psi bar multiplied by gamma zero. So psi bar is actually, in some sense, it transforms in the opposite representation. It transforms with the inverse matrix to psi. That's what it means from a very, mechanical point of view. One way of looking at it is that to compare psi bar psi with psi dagger psi, then it turns out that this guy is actually the zeroth component of a four-dimensional vector, which we know is not a scalar. But psi bar and psi is not the zeroth component of any object. It's by itself is a scalar. So it's a little abstract, but you know, there are all these different aspects to psi bar, right? So I don't exactly know what there are lots of physical things associated with psi bar, but it's psi bar has, okay, let's think of it in this way. Psi bar has well-defined space-time transformation properties under the Lorentz group, okay? All right. So it turns out that, okay, we'll take a break in about 7 minutes, okay? It turns out that it's useful to classify the different kinds of Lorentz covariant objects that we can make out of spinners under what is known as a parity transformation. So I don't think, did Dan talk about parity at all? So okay, we'll do a tutorial next week on parity as well. So, but now I'm just gonna introduce the most basic notion of parity. So parity, which I'll use the word big P, sends the three-dimensional coordinates to minus. So parity is also, this is a solution to the definition of, to this equation. That means the parity operator also leaves the Minkowski metric invariant. So the metric, the matrix that does this, which I will just call P, is nothing but 1 minus 1 minus 1 minus 1, everything else being 0. And you can very easily verify that this is also a solution to this equation. Okay? However, the determinant of parity is minus 1. Therefore, it is not a member of SO1, 3, because S means determinant 1. So that means that parity is a transformation which is not continuously related to the identity. It is a discrete transformation. There's another space-time transformation which is discrete and which is also important, is called the time reversal. And time reversal just takes the time coordinate and inverts it. And this is also a solution to this, but the time reversal operator, well, matrix, is this guy. So if you add T and P to the Lorentz group, then you get what is known as the non-orthochronous improper Lorentz group. What time T does is that it flips the future light cone to the past light cone. So, you know, why would you want to consider these transformations? It seems bizarre, because you'd expect that, you know, if some physical process happens in our universe, it should also happen in a parity inverted universe, right? So if you think about it, parity can be thought about as reflection through a mirror and then rotation by 180 degrees in the plane of the mirror. Right? So effectively, you know, what parity is saying is that if I see a physical process happening in our universe, you might ask the question, the physical process that we see in the mirror, does that happen in our universe? And the answer is no. That the universe, our universe, is actually violates parity. And therefore, you know, our Lagrangians, you know, actually don't have to be, they have to be Lorentz invariant of this group, but they don't have to be parity invariant. In fact, the theory of weak interaction violates parity, as you will see. Okay? And there have been several Nobel Prizes associated with that. However, there's a theorem called the CPT theorem. Which says that, you know, local, you know, Lorentz invariant, and here I mean SO1, 3 invariant, QFTs with Hermitian Hamiltonians must be invariant under the combined operation of parity, time, and what is known as charge conjugation. So let's call this CPT. So the charge conjugation is an internal discrete transformation which sends particles to antiparticles. So it's only that combination that has to be satisfied, but each individual discrete transformation can be violated, okay? So to figure out how parity acts on spinners, let us use a heuristic argument. Okay? So suppose we have a particle described by some wave function which is a Weyl spinner. So I'm using a quantum mechanical argument here. Then under parity, the helicity, which is the projection of the three-dimensional spin in the direction of the momentum of a particle, the normalized, of a, say, a left-handed particle, flips. And let's draw a cartoon. This is our mirror. And suppose we have a particle traveling in this direction. And it has some spin, which I will denote as a rotation, in the, spin it with the red. So if we reflect this in the mirror, then we see that the momentum, direction of the momentum of the particle changes, where this is our axis. And, but the direction of the rotation doesn't. Of course, parity involves rotating by 180 degrees in the plane of the mirror. You also have to take that into account. And you can also convince yourself if the particle was going, say, this way, and the rotation was like this, then parity would give you a particle going this way, but the rotation in this direction. So this is just to convince yourself that under parity, a left-handed vowel spinner goes to a right-handed vowel spinner. So we can implement this on a Dirac spinner by saying that under parity, the Dirac spinner is simply multiplied by gamma zero. But I will be a little bit more careful because we'll be dealing with fields. So this is our Dirac spinner. It has some space-time dependence. Under parity, we will assume that this so in the argument, you have to flip the sign of the spatial dependence. So now that we have introduced parity, we can now classify all the different kinds of objects that we can construct out of spinners. We've already seen a scalar. So scalar is this object. And under parity, it does not change. So only its argument, the spatial part of its argument, change. But we can also define what is known as a pseudo-scalar. Which is, if we just insert a gamma 5 between the Dirac spinner and its Dirac conjugate, then using the properties of gamma matrices, you can see that it picks up a minus sign under this discrete transformation. Oh, sorry, there's a gamma 5 here. And this is, let's just verify this. So, this is basically what our object is. And under parity, we get an extra gamma 0 here, because if the parity Hermitian conjugate of this guy, but this gamma 0 was already there. There's a gamma 5. There's a gamma 0 for coming from this psi. And so now if I take this gamma 0 and anticommute, then this becomes gamma 0 squared. But the anticommutation relation, the anticommutation gives me a minus sign, and therefore we get this gamma. So this minus sign, the part pseudo refers to the minus sign. But now if you do a Lorentz transformation such as a boost or a rotation, because the gamma matrices don't change under those transformation, there are two of these guys. Gamma 5 commutes with the generators of the Lorentz transformation. It turns out that under Lorentz transformation, this thing doesn't change. So it's a scalar under boost and rotation. But under discrete transformation, it picks up a minus sign. Therefore, we call it a pseudoscalar. So we can also define a vector out of, this is much better. So a vector is given by this construction. You just insert a gamma. You just sandwich it between psi and psi bar. And under parity, you can check that the zeroth component of this guy doesn't change, but the spatial components pick up a minus sign, just as you would expect for a vector. And then if you do a space-time transformation, because of the gamma matrix here, you can show using that very nice identity, which relates SL2 spin group to the Lorentz group, that this actually transforms like a vector. Now we can generalize the vector to what is known as an axial or pseudo-vector. The term axial vector is more popular. And that's given by psi bar. You insert a gamma 5. And under parity, now the zeroth component picks up a sign. I'm going to be a bit lazy and not write the arguments anymore. But the spatial components do not, flip their sign. And that is, as we know, is an axial vector or a pseudo-vector. Can anyone give an example of a pseudo-vector from classical mechanics? Right.
angular velocity. Okay. As I said before, the current of weak interaction, you will see in standard model, the current associated with weak interaction has V minus A structure, vector minus axial vector structure. So I have a little proof that our spin group is composed of some copies of SL2C. I will save it for the last bit of the lecture in case we have time. Otherwise, come and talk to me in the tutorial. I'll explain it to you. Yes? On there? Okay. Well, the gamma naught, right. Right. So this is basically, you want to understand this relationship, right? And so this is kind of, I'm assuming that this happens. The way I've motivated it is that if I have a spinning particle moving in some direction, and I do a parity transformation, if the particle is spinning in the left-handed sense, it becomes, it starts spinning in the right-handed sense. Sorry. Okay, that's not right. So what I mean is that if you take a left-handed particle, so a quantum particle that is described, say, by a left-handed Wahl spinner, then under parity, it takes you to a right-handed, Wahl spinner. And the way I've motivated it is by this cartoon diagram, right? And the gamma zero, that's, if you remember, in the chiral or Wahl basis is this matrix. So whereas psi of D in the Wahl basis is given by something like this. So if you multiply this with gamma of zero, then this thing flips. So we exchange a left-handed particle with a right-handed particle and vice versa by multiplying by gamma zero. That's why I'm kind of, that's the observation I use to write down that relationship where we are saying that under parity, the Dirac spinner should transform like that way. And then after that, this is kind of algebra that if psi transforms in that way, then under parity, psi dagger should transform in this way, but gamma zero is Hermitian, so this is this. And so we combine this with the way psi transforms into that relationship and then use the anti-commutation between gamma zero and gamma five to do that. Okay. So here what we have done is that, under parity, there's a gamma zero dagger here, but gamma zero dagger is gamma zero because it's Hermitian. And so we can get rid of this guy. And there's a gamma zero here. And then what you can do is that gamma zero squares to one. And then you can bring, so this is equals to psi dagger gamma five gamma zero of psi. And then you can bring the gamma zero over here, but since it anti-commutes with gamma five, you pick up a minus sign. Then the gamma zero multiplying this guy gives you psi bar gamma five of psi, okay? Sorry?
Both gamma matrix and inner time.
Right. There's some, yeah, exactly. So.
So it looks very obvious in chiral basis, but it is still true that gamma B, I mean, drop spinner.
Right, yeah, that should do the same job in the other bases, yeah. Okay, where was I? Oh, yeah. So at last, we are entering physics land. I'm sure you guys have been having Lagrange withdrawal, yes? Right. I actually haven't made it very precise. It's actually the helicity is related to its gamma five eigenvalue, and it'll turn out. So I've used a very sort of heuristic argument. It'll turn out that the Weyl spinner, if it satisfies what is known as the Weyl equation, it's actually a massless equation, and for such a massless particle, the helicity is a good quantum number. It's a quantum number that is independent of the reference frame. You can boost and it'll still be the same. And then if you, it's something intrinsic to the particle. So if you then, this is kind of a more of a hand-waving quantum mechanical argument of views. But once you see the Lagrangian for the Weyl spinners, you'll see that they must be massless. Spinners which satisfy the Weyl equation. So, I mean, in other words, the massless spinners, they're eigenstates of gamma five, but they're also eigenstates of the helicity operator, and that's a one-to-one correspondence. All right, okay, Lagrangian for spinners. Since we want some kind of dynamics. Right? So we want some derivative operator in our Lagrangian. So what is a derivative operator? In flat space-time, a derivative operator transforms like a covariant vector, right? So we can try the kinetic term for a Dirac spinner. Let's write down something that is a scalar. So we need, because we want a derivative operator which transforms as a covariant vector, we need a contravariant spinorial object, right? And put an I there, which I'll explain why. So it should be clear that this is a scalar. So you might ask, why did we not try a Lagrangian which was of this form, which was also a scalar? The problem with this Lagrangian is that nothing in this Lagrangian forces psi to be a spinner. We can treat this Lagrangian as a Lagrangian for four massless scalar fields. complex scalar fields, right? Whereas this Lagrangian tells you that psi better be a spinner for if this is to be a Lorentz invariant. The other thing is that the spin statistics theorem, which we'll talk about tomorrow, tells us that when you quantize a spinner, it'll give you particles which satisfy Fermi-Dirac statistics. You can then show using that argument that any Lagrangian like this will lead to a Hamiltonian, which is not bounded from below. Disaster. So we don't consider this. We consider this Lagrangian. Okay? Yes?
Could you repeat how the gamma mu forces the size to be spinner?
Right. So if you do a Lorentz transformation, then you have, this L kinetic goes to I psi bar S inverse gamma mu. And then this guy transforms with a Lorentz transformation matrix, which is the transpose matrix of the usual thing. And then the spinner, of course, transforms like this. Now, S's depend on the parameters of your Lorentz transformation, but as you know, Lorentz transformations are global transformations. So the derivative operator does not act on it. So we can write this as psi bar S inverse gamma mu, and then these guys have spinner indices. These guys don't have spinner indices, so I can bring this over here. This bug becomes S. So gamma mu sigma. But we have that wonderful identity, which tells us this thing is nothing but mu theta gamma of theta. And then this is just the inverse matrix of this, which gives you a Kronecker delta. And in the end, you get back the same expression as you started with. Okay? So what is the action? The kinetic part of the action is just the Lagrangian integrated over all space-time. Now, if I assume that my field configurations are such that as you go off to spatial infinity, that they die off, then using that, you can basically use Gauss's theorem and show that this is real, up to boundary term. And that's why I introduced the I here. If you didn't have the I here, then you would be able to show that it will be imaginary. But we want our action to be real so that when we quantize it, it's Hermitian. Otherwise, we would not get a Hermitian Hamiltonian from it. So our Dirac, the kinetic part of our Dirac Lagrangian is real. So now let's ask what is the mass dimension of our spinner field.
the mass dimension of our spinner field is determined by the dimension of the kinetic term in the action. So we know that in units in which h bar is equal to c bar is equal to 1, the action is dimensionless. Because action, right. But the measure of integral has dimension minus 4. The gamma matrices are just numbers, so they have dimension 0. This implies that the dimension of the spinner and its conjugate is 3/2. So given this, now we can write down a mass term for our Dirac spinner. And we suspect that it'll be some sort of quadratic. This is a scalar. What is the coefficient? Let's write that as a constant, minus m. Then this dimensional analysis tells you that the mass dimension of m is 1. If you go back and did this analysis again for scalar field, you will figure out that the coefficient to the phi squared term there had mass dimension 2, and that's why you wrote m squared. In four dimensions, it's 1. Yes? Right. So, if you choose these units, then what you're saying is that the speed of light is dimensionless, and that's so this. The speed is essentially, distance over time, right? And so mass to the minus 4, right? And right. Mass is essentially, so you also have to, use the fact that h bar is 1. And then, you have expressions in your quantum theory such as e to the power minus I h bar e of t, right? And this is in some general, the everyday units, right? So when you said h equals to 1, that means that the rest of, everything else have to be dimensionless. So you know that the dimension of time would be the negative, the dimension of energy, right? So, similarly, if you say, if you look at the part of your wave function, which is the momentum and the mass, and the space, you find that the dimension of the momentum is negative the dimension of space. And then, you can say, well, E is E squared is M squared plus P squared, as Einstein told us, where I've set C equals to 1. So that means that, now
Right. So this tells us that the dimension of P must be the same as the dimension of mass. And then if you look at this, this tells us the dimension of spatial components, space must be inverse of the dimension of mass. And the same, and E also has the same dimension as mass, and therefore T also has dimension which is negative mass. So that's why, you know, here we have dt and d cubed of x. So this guy has dimension mass dimension minus 1. These guy has mass dimension minus 3. So the total is mass dimension minus 4. Sorry? Yeah. All right. So thus we have the Dirac Lagrangian. Which is psi bar gamma mu, right? So we can now work out what the equation of motion is. Now you have to treat the spinner psi and its conjugate to be independent. And if you derive the equation of motion for psi, you get an equation of motion that is the Hermitian conjugate of the equation of motion that you get from psi bar. So I'll just do the psi bar. Well, so we know that by now you should have this memorized, although sometimes I forget myself. Can you give me 10 minutes? Awesome. So you get right. So if you just do this part, you know, a partial derivative, you get, and I'll leave this as an exercise for you, the famous Dirac equation, which is also written sometimes, well, often actually, as this, where the slash notation means this. It's known as the Feynman slash notation. I'm sure Dirac was horrified when he saw that. Right. Okay. So now that we have written down the Lagrangian for the Dirac equation, you want to say, okay, what is the Lagrangian, say, for a vowel spinner? So from the relationships that I've written down so far, you can show that the vowel spinner, the left-handed and the right-handed vowel spinners, and the sigma and sigma bar matrices transform in the following way. So I'm not going to give you the detail of this, but I'm going to give you the final result. The left-handed vowel spinner transforms according to some 2x2 matrix, which is the block the upper block of the four-dimensional spinner the transformation matrix, and the right-handed transforms like this. So what I mean by S, L, and SR is that we have the big S in the vowel basis. They should have this form. Then chi L dagger transforms as chi L dagger SR inverse.
and phi r dagger transforms as phi r dagger SL inverse, then you can show that this Lagrangian, oh my God, this is so horrible. Is invariant under Lorentz transformation. And the final bit of information that you need to show that is how sigma bar transform, or the properties of sigma bar. And the property of sigma bar that is you need is, and which you can derive, is this thing. And I've given you all the elements. This is just the two-dimensional, the one part of the bigger, of the Lorentz transformation relationship I wrote down. So by using this relationship and similar arguments, you can show that this is Lorentz invariant. So this is the kinetic term for a left-handed valve spinner. Yes? Oh, sorry. Yeah. Sorry, I'm rushing at this point. I shouldn't. So let's call this left. The kinetic term for the right-handed valve spinner is given by something similar. It's I times psi r of dagger. But now instead of sigma bar of mu, you just have sigma here. And this is also Lorentz invariant. And then you can say, okay, what are the mass terms that we can write down for the valve spinner? Well, you can try this. So for the left-handed guy, you can try this. But the way psi L and psi R, psi L dagger transform, they transform with different matrices, so that's not Lorentz invariant. It turns out that you cannot make a mass term of that form with valve spinners. So why is that impossible? I mean, I'm not going to give you a proof, but you know, the naive expectation that you have is not Lorentz invariant. Then you can try other bilinears of chi L and chi L bar, but you'll find that none of those bilinears actually are Lorentz invariant. I mean, I think it should probably be an exhaustive because there aren't too many possibilities. Probably that's how you want to prove this. Oh dear, I have a lot more, but I'll have to come back to it next time. Let me just tell you what the that's exactly what I'm going to do, is and show that that's actually very different. So if you now go to the Val basis and rewrite the Dirac mass term, so the Dirac mass term, it turns out to be this. It is Lorentz invariant. But it mixes the left-handed and the right-handed component. So in some sense, the Dirac mass term can be thought of as an interaction term between its left-handed and right-handed component. Or you can think of the Dirac spinner as being physically as being composed of two spinners, one left-handed and one right-handed. So in the last few minutes, I'm just going to tell you about a third kind of spinners we can have,
And this is actually quite important, both for particle physics applications as well as condensed matter applications, apparently. And these are called Weyl spinners, Majorana spinners. So a Dirac spinner, by now you're sick of hearing that it can be decomposed into a left-handed and right-handed component. But there's nothing stopping us from saying that we can impose the condition that the left-handed and the right-handed components are somehow related by complex conjugation. We can demand that. If you demand that, we are reducing the number of degrees of freedom, but we can always do that. So we can write down a spinner which in the Weyl basis, whose left-handed and right-handed components are related like so. In other words, the left-handed components, the right-handed components are not independent. They are related by the complex conjugation. This, of course, transforms in the way that it should. And such a spinner is called a Majorana spinner. But I've only given you the form of a Majorana spinner in a very particular basis but we want to give a definition of a Majorana spinner in some arbitrary basis. To do that, you know, we introduce an operator called the charge conjugation operator, which takes a Dirac spinner to its charge conjugate, which is defined by minus I gamma 2 psi star, okay? So this is how we define this psi c. Then the Majorana spinner is a spinner which satisfies this condition that it is its own charge conjugate. Physically, the charge conjugation will turn out to be that you're changing particles with the antiparticles. So Majorana spinners, they are their own antiparticles. And sometimes this condition, because it relates a spinner to its complex conjugate, a two-dimensional spinner to its complex conjugate, is also known as a reality condition, and this is sometimes called a real spinner. In fact, there is a basis for your gamma matrices called the Majorana basis, no surprise, in which the gamma matrices are all imaginary, but your spinners are real. Your Majorana spinners are real. So next time, before I start quantizing the Dirac field, I will have to talk about the classical solutions of Dirac equation. So maybe I can have 5 more minutes. What do you guys think? I just don't want to butt into the next lecture. Do you think, he doesn't come very early, right? Okay, let me have 5 more minutes. I'm very sorry for taking up so much time. You know what? Okay, let's just see what we can do with these boards. Okay. So I've told you that the Dirac spinner is also, so a solution to the Dirac equation is also a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. So that means that we can write a solution to the Dirac equation as a plane wave solution. Of this form. Sorry, this is a 4-dimensional. So we'll choose the momentum, the zeroth component of the momentum to be positive. And such solutions are called positive frequency solutions. So mind you, the positive frequency solution has a minus sign here. And here the P refers to the momentum. It is not a spinner index. So if we claim that this is a solution to the Dirac equation, then these guys, these are the spinners. So if I take the A component, we take the A component of this, you know, column matrix, these guys have to satisfy some equation. So you take this, plug this into this, in the our favorite basis, the Weyl basis, then you have, if you write U of P in terms of two-dimensional spinners in momentum space, then you find that these two spinners have to satisfy this equation, these equations, that the, so this is a four-dimensional inner product. So we have to solve these things. So let's solve this in a very in a particular reference frame. So let's choose our P to be the momentum of a stationary particle. Let's call this P0. Then these relationships become trivial. So for P0, this means U1 has to be equal to U2. And let's choose normalization of this, where psi is a two-dimensional vector, is a two-dimensional spinner. And we choose this to be normalized to this one. And then what you do is that you make a boost on this P. And you know how, when you do a boost on some space-time object, how it manifests itself on the spinners, right? You know all of that. We've been talking about this nonstop. So you use those relationships, and you find that in any arbitrary frame, U of P is given by square root of P dot sigma times psi, P dot sigma bar. And then we can define U bar of P to be, again, U dagger of P gamma 0. And then using the identity, there's a bar here, which is, of course, now this is, when I don't have the bar, this is a four-dimensional contraction. You can show that this is 2m that is, this inner product is Lorentz invariant. So because we have this psi has two components. There are two linearly independent parts, which we write as psi s dagger, psi s and psi r. And we choose them, we can choose them to be orthogonal to each other. So in the end, we can write u bar of s of p, u of r of P, where S and R denote to the psi that's contained in them, and that's equal to 2m delta SR. And I'll stop here because, you know, the blackboard needs to be cleaned, and, you know, it takes a while for them to dry. So let's stop here for today, okay? Thank you.